You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
You could be excused if you thought that Christianity was unique in gathering its people together around a ritual called communion. That's certainly been the company line for 2,000 years, but while that works from a marketing perspective, it's not completely true. Does this sound familiar? He who will not eat of my body and drink of my blood, so that he will be made one with me and I with him, the same shall not know salvation. Jesus? No. A guy named Mithra, predating Jesus by hundreds of years. He was a Persian godman who was a kind of patron saint of much of the Roman legion, who in turn carried the story of Mithra across the Roman Empire. Then along comes the Gospel of John with a passage that sounds like downright plagiarism. So Jesus said to them, "Truly I tell you, unless you eat of the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Those who eat my flesh and drink my blood have eternal life." How did that happen? What do we do with this? Let's rewind to Paul's correspondence to the Corinthians. The only way we know how to do communion today, or what we base our communion ritual on today, is because the Corinthians were messing it up back then. So Paul wrote to them and set them straight with our passage today. The plot thickens when you remember two things. The Gospels were written after Paul, so Paul didn't have them to go on. Otherwise, he would have quoted from them for authority. And two, Paul was born and raised in a town called Tarsus. Why is that important? Because Tarsus was the Vatican of Mithraism. If his authentic letters are any indication, Paul knew virtually zip about Jesus' actual historical life and sayings. But Paul grew up marinated in Mithraism. So what do we do with that? The mind boggles. But what we can know is that our communion ritual parallels the meal rituals practiced by many other religions and mystery cults of Jesus' day, including, of course, the Jewish Passover celebration. It's all intertwined in ways that are both fascinating and humbling. In the late second century, Tertullian wrote, "The devil copies certain things of those that be divine." But in fact, we know now that Mithraism predates Christianity and not the other way around. One of the things you may or may not have noticed is that when we were doing communion in person, our ritual together at the Fountains avoids the blood and body imagery in favor of the cup of God's blessing and the bread of new life. The rationale behind that is for a sermon another time, but suffice it to say, whatever Jesus said, he didn't mean that the wine was literally his blood and the bread literally his body. It's called metaphor. Hang on to that. Our passage today is one snapshot of how Paul, likely unhindered by actual facts about the event, thought communion ought to be done nearly 2,000 years ago in his time and in his place. So today, however we approach communion, we are just one small part of a tangled story that began long before we can imagine and will continue to evolve and change in generations to come. Let's listen to Paul's idea of how he wanted the Corinthians to practice communion.
Our words of wisdom are from 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 23 through 26. "For I received from the Lord what I also handed on to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took a loaf of bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body that is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way, he took the cup also after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this "As often as you drink it in remembrance of me, for as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Thanks be to God.
It's the first Sunday of the month, which back in the bad old pre-COVID days means communion. I miss doing communion with you, being there in person, singing the songs of sharing, hearing the words that for me are both comforting and challenging. And we're still a ways off from being able to safely be with one another, whatever the new normal communion will look like going forward. This suspension of in-person communion has been especially hard for a lot of denominations for which communion is really the main thing people come for every week. For them, it's less about the fellowship or the message and more about getting that communion fix, or in pandemic terms, that inoculation from sin, or however people think about it. So there's been a lot of frantic efforts to try and maintain some kind of pandemic substitute. You may have heard about other churches experimenting with drive-through or outdoor communion. Some churches have sued the government for the right to meet in person. Some have mailed or delivered pre-blessed communion kits or single-serve disposable communion cups. I have to admit, when I first saw the coffee creamer-style pods years ago, I thought it was a joke. I was that or a sure sign of the apocalypse. I just didn't think that convenient and disposable are words that I'd usually think of when I think of communion. But this necessary suspension of in-person communion has shone a light on some uncomfortable truths, namely that long before the pandemic, communion has become something of a problem. First off, most people don't understand communion. And to be honest, most churches don't understand communion. In the United Methodist tradition, communion is what's called a memorial meal. We are remembering and acting out what Jesus practiced, specifically welcoming everyone to the table, especially those whom proper society has deemed unclean or outcast. So Methodists have what's called an open table, where everyone is welcome to join in. You don't have to be a member of the church. You don't have to be baptized. You don't even have to be a Christian. Everyone is welcome at the table. But sadly, many denominations have weaponized communion, making it an exclusive perk of the in crowd. Oh, I'm so sorry. If you haven't spoken the right creeds and brought your magic decoder ring, then you are most certainly not welcome to come to the table. Wow, few things could be further from the spirit of what Jesus practiced, but that's reality. So it's no wonder that people have come to resent the church as elitist and cliquish, and because the church as a whole no longer has the cultural power to make unaffiliated people feel guilty, it becomes more and more irrelevant to the broader world as a crusty relic of exclusivity and privilege. Secondly, people misunderstand the blood and guts aspect of communion. Historically, some denominations have even emphasized the literal bloodiness of the ritual. In part, that's due to the language in our passage today, which I take as metaphor, but which has been the source of generations of theological squabbles that have obscured what I think was the original intent of the practice. So let me put it bluntly. For United Methodists, at least, there's not some magic that happens to the elements to somehow make them literally blood and body, or even make them spiritually super potent. For us, the magic is in followers of Jesus acting out the manner in which Jesus welcomed everyone to join in the meal, especially those who would otherwise be excluded. That's the transformation. That's the point. So when communion is both withheld from unworthy people and is claimed to be somehow magically transformed into something it clearly is not, people who value inclusivity and integrity of thought are understandably skeptical. Add to that the information that's freely available online about the mystery cult origins of Christianity's claimed unique rituals, and the credibility of the church is rightly questioned. The other thing that needs to be acknowledged is that much of the fuss over how or whether to do communion has come out of a sense of defensiveness. The United Methodist Church recognizes two sacraments, baptism and communion, and for the most part reserves the performance of these rituals to clergy alone. So I've had the sense that some worry that doing communion in any other way than having a pastor physically consecrate specific elements and distribute them undermines the authority of the clergy in the church. In other words, we have to defend that power. Communion is a sacrament, yes. But remember that the word sacrament is from the Latin sacramentum, which means to make sacred or holy. In other words, it simply means making an everyday something like bread, wine, or water sacred or holy. And I think any of us can and should see every day as full of opportunities to make what we do charged with mystery and awe. Our relationships, how we spend our time, how we spend our money, and yes, how we approach something as mundane as the everyday meal. Embracing life and recognizing its sacredness is not something that's limited to clergy alone. Likewise, the specific elements of communion are not important. There are no official elements prescribed or officially authorized. A wide variety of bread is used, be it crackers or pre-cut bread cubes, whole loaves, or those awful styrofoam wafers. A wide variety of contents are offered in your typical cup, be it wine or grape juice of various colors. And in Wesley's Love Feast, water is used. Now, I don't know how else to take this other than it being a demonstration of the flexibility of this ritual. So let's review. Communion is not an exclusive ritual for people who have sworn to believe certain things in order to be included. Nor are everyday items magically transformed into something they're not by an authority figure with special powers. So what is it? Communion is a stylized banquet of unconditional acceptance, a celebration of diversity, a safe space where the beloved community affirms and empowers everyone to be and do everything that they were created to be and do. And guess what? It can take on so many different forms. As I've shared with you before, some of the most meaningful communion experiences of my life have been at camp with stale hot dog buns and water, or on work teams with chips and salsa. So I, for one, am open to the way the Spirit is at work in all kinds of creative and resourceful ways. To that end, I'd like to share a video with you from Living the Questions. About 15 years ago, my partner in crime, Jeff Proctor Murphy, and I dragged our friend and mentor, Tech Sample, out into the middle of the desert to lend some dramatic scenery to some of Tech's amazing stories. In this video, Tech describes what was for him one of the most powerful Eucharistic or communion experiences of his life. The timing is especially apropos as we honor the life and work of John Lewis this week, because the march that Tex describes is the one that took place as a direct result of John Lewis having organized the march we now know as Bloody Sunday, only 2 weeks before.
In 1965, a group of civil rights demonstrators were met at the Edmund Pettus Bridge by the police, who violently attacked them. That demonstration led Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to call for a march from Selma to Montgomery. At the time, I was a social action executive for the Massachusetts Council of Churches. My job was to help organize and send people to that march. That next morning, we began that last phase of the march into Montgomery. A decision had been made that when we approached Montgomery, we would take a jog to go through the black community as a show of solidarity and support. I was on the outside and looked down the line of march, and as we were walking along, I could see an African-American woman coming up the line of march, counter to our direction. But in one hand, she had a gallon jug of Kool-Aid, and in the other, she had 6 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I don't know why, but when she got to me, she shoved those sandwiches into one of my hands and that gallon jug of Kool-Aid in the other. And then she looked at me and said, "Hell, brother, we're gonna overcome." Well, when I looked back up the line of march, she had gone. But I took one of those peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, passed them to the person next to me in the line. Then I took that gallon jug of Kool-Aid. Then I handed that to the person next to me in the line. And it just hit me. This is my body broken for you. This is my blood which is shed for you and for many. That remains the most powerful Eucharistic moment of my life. I chilled for a mile after that. And we continued that march on into Montgomery. Once there, in the front of the Capitol, we began a long demonstration. And there we all sat down on the grass, thousands of us. As usual, we had singers and musicians. We had speeches. It was a rousing time together. And yet we all waited for Dr. King because we knew he would bring the message that would close out the event. Finally, the time came for Dr. King's speech. I still regard that speech in Montgomery as the equal of the one that he had made in Washington in 1963. And when Dr. King enters into the last part of that speech, he began a kind of a call and response with himself initially. He shouts out, "How long?" And he responds to himself, "Not long. How long? Not long. How long? Not long, because no lie can live forever. How long? Not long, because while the arc of the moral universe is long, it bends toward justice. How long? Not long. How long? Not long." Then he shouted at us, "How long?" And those thousands of people got up off the ground and on their feet and shouted back, "Nah." It would be 3 years before his body would be broken and his blood would be shed. But as long as I live, I shall never forget that wonderful black woman shoving the elements of the Eucharist into my hands and then proclaiming, "Hell, brother, we're gonna overcome."
Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, a jug full of Kool-Aid, the most powerful Eucharistic experience in Texas life. Was it the elements? No. Was it the context? You bet. The transformative power of grace can and will be at work wherever and whenever the followers of Jesus make it their business to, as John Lewis said, get in good trouble. Necessary trouble. Eating a morsel of bread and drinking grape juice together seems so irrelevant in the midst of all that is going on in the world. But it models something that is often lost on many people who are busy thinking about communion as a magic elixir that is all about them as individuals. Communion is about reenacting what Jesus did, bringing a ragtag group of people together, each with different pain and anxiety and hopes, reminding us that we are interconnected by so much. And when we act out this symbolic meal, we celebrate the community to which we belong, even if we're not physically together in person. This is the meal that Paul wanted us to remember. "For I received from the Lord what I also handed on to you," he wrote. It's not about bread and wine magically changing into body and blood. It's about remembering that Jesus invited everyone to the table. It's the invitation, the welcoming of everyone that connects us one to another, no matter who we are and where we are and what we are. Eleanor Roosevelt used to say, "Life is what you make it. Always has been, always will be." It's the same with communion. It's what you make it. So make it about the sharing, the welcoming of all, and reminding ourselves what the world could be like, what the beloved community could be like. Make it about being reminded of our call as followers of Jesus to stand firm in defiance of a world that wants to divide us and generate fear and uncertainty. With Jesus, make it about standing up and, if necessary, taking a knee against the prejudices that look at others and treat others as less than human. Make it about rejecting the conventional wisdom that says greatness is about power, and instead, hold on to what Jesus taught, that the greatest among us is the servant of all, particularly the least and the last. Make it about embracing the possibility that, as unlikely as it may seem right now, there is hope for a future where doing justice overcomes the primal urge toward narcissism, hateful speech, and acts of violence. Jesus' teachings call us to be connected, not only with other people, but with creation itself. We, as individuals and as a faith community, are a small part of something much bigger, a fragile conspiracy of kindness, of generosity, of commiserating, of doing justice, of resistance, of patience, and risk-taking. It starts here, and we're the people to start it. So however we acknowledge the act of communion in our lives, no matter how humble our efforts, no matter what the elements, no matter how separated we are from one another physically, may we remember that Jesus shared everyday meals with people from across all the religious, economic, social, and ethnic racial barriers that his world would otherwise put in their way. And we're called to do the same. It is what we make it. So check out the links accompanying this video on both YouTube and Facebook. They'll take you to a PDF doc that you can download as you set aside a particular meal to be intentional about making it sacred with the words of blessing provided. Or you can go to a pre-recorded video and follow along with whatever elements you have on hand. Tex recommends peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and if you've got it, a jug full of Kool-Aid. While virtual, I aim to make it about sharing with you in both spirit and in action. May you know the Spirit's presence in every aspect of your life. How long? Not long. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information on our faith community or to support this outreach with a donation, be sure to visit us online at www.reachtouchpeople.org. teach.com.